This is why we love racing in all its forms.
Max Delight shot through, grabbed the lead. Max Delight wins it.
The rail now for Zipping Rambo goes through in the Sandown Cup.
Very elegant. 10 Group 1s and now the greatest of them all, the Melbourne Cup.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Good morning to all our listeners this morning. Hope it's a lovely morning for you and you're looking forward to a big race day. Simone Fisher, Matt Stewart, good morning to both of you. I'm glad to have your company again. It doesn't quite feel the same without all three of us kicking off at 6 a.m.
Good morning to both of you. I've had a very interesting week with my youngest up at Melbourne Polytechnics, formerly Northern TAFE, up at Eden Park, up in the middle of nowhere, up near Whittlesea, and it's great to see these, to witness it firsthand, the programs that are underway for people who want to get involved in the industry. A lot has been said about shortage of track work riders and things like that, and young Max is one of a group of about 8 or 9. There's probably 7 girls. There's Max and there's an older guy who's in his 50s whose dream is to ride at the picnics, and he's learning how to do that and probably has to lose about 15 kilos as well. But and age range, probably Max is 15 and the rest of them are probably in their late teens and early 20s. And it's just great. They're learning on X-race horses. They've got some great skilled teachers. It goes on for a few weeks. And by the time these guys come out, a lot of the girls particularly have got equestrian backgrounds, so they already know how to ride. But fascinating to see the education process of people transitioning into becoming, ground-level grassroots participants in the game.
Matt, what is it that Max wants to do in the racing industry? Because he's quite tall, isn't he? So a jockey is probably not on the cards.
Sneaky bugger, I'm telling you. I still reckon he wants to ride at the picnics, but he's just denying that that's what his ambition is. But
right.
I think he just wants to keep his options open. Like he really is quite amazing. He's been working for Mick Dent since he was a little kid. And goes up to Gerald Egan's and Alison Bennett's and rides and learns and very dedicated. And I think he wants to just know as much about the horse as he possibly can, work for as many stables as he can. The dream, if anyone from Darley's listening, Darley Flying Start would be nice in a couple of years. And just to become a good horseman and then see where it takes him, whether he wants to become a vet or whether he wants to be a trainer or whatever it is, just to give himself a foundation where whatever direction he goes, he knows that he's well-armed. So, yeah, it's fascinating. We all know what a tricky job it is to be a horse trainer, but, he's on his way to doing something.
When I was coming through, I tried my hand at everything. I think I've mentioned it before. I rode track work a couple of times, private training track. But, I mean, we'd do all the sorts of things, yoke up harness horses, saddle up thoroughbreds. I would strap. I'd do all sorts of things. I never thought that I was going to take that career path, but it complemented the other work I was doing. With your journalism background, Matt, were there things that you sort of embraced or things that you did knowing most likely they might complement what you are doing, getting a bit hands-on and a bit physical in certain things instead of just playing golf and maybe lifting a beer?
Yeah, exactly. I reckon it's really important. All the best journos I've known, Andrew Rule's a good example. He wrote at the picnics. I think you've got to experience the spectrum as best you can to be as good at what you do or to be confident in what you do and to know that you understand things you're writing about. And I rode Pony Club as a kid. I've been out of track work for 1,000 years and hopefully through my kids that we get that experience of the love of the animal and understand what happens in stables and what their frustrations are and what motivates them and things like that. So, and I know, Simone, you've done a lot more of the horsey stuff than I have as well. I just think it doesn't seem connected, but it is one part of your life to another, and I think they all help.
Oh, for sure. And I think just having that appreciation of the horse as well, and you have that empathy, and you see all that coming out more now. And with this welfare report this week too, I think people that, you have your hard trainers back in the days and the horse was just a commodity. And now these days, the trainers are having perhaps more of a rapport with the horse. They're not just a good trainer with a good horse. They actually get the animal, perhaps. I'm getting that feeling, and I get that feeling from this welfare report coming down that no longer are you just a horse trainer. You have to have that empathy, that understanding, and become a good horse person as well, and consider the whole part of racing, not just what occurs on the track and what ends up in the bank account at the end of the week. I get that feeling. I know in greyhounds it's definitely the feeling, and that there's been a shift in perception. There's been a shift in how people are approaching training. They're not just a dog, and like I say, at the end of the day, at the end of the week, what money have they made? They are considering these as more of just a product, and I really get that feeling, and I think it's true. If you can appreciate from the grassroots level and right through the whole process and cycle, it will make you a better person in the end, and it would be better for the animals. I can't see any other way.
Exactly right. And Dan, you've experienced it as well, and I think if you're going to comment on issues in racing, even if it's something like the whip, you know, if you spend a bit of time around horses and around stables, you understand the anatomy of the horse a little bit. You understand a little bit more about how there are times where they need to be dominated. I mean, it's easy to have a nirvana sort of view where, you know, the animal can't be touched and it has to be wrapped in cotton wool and so on, but they weigh 600 kilos, some of them, and they can kill. So you also have to recognise that there is a degree of mastering of the animal as well that's required, and sometimes that pushes the boundaries of what society deems as perfect behaviour or not. Sometimes a horse has to be really dominated in order to be for the participant to be safe. So, and for the horse to have a behaviour pattern that is more acceptable. So, yeah, I think every journo, every racing journo, should go to track work like they used to, and should immerse themselves in stables, and should get to know the jockeys and not just the fancy trainers and the fancy owners, but the little people as well. And then they get a much better gauge of a measure of the sport that they're covering.
And horses and greyhounds, for that matter, you know, I like them to even domesticated animals, that they want to have that interaction so they can learn. They still want to be learned. And some horses are referred to as smart, you know, and others aren't. They're like people. There are good-looking people and there are ugly-looking people. There are fast people, there are slow people. But it's the truth, isn't it? And just because you might be a little bit slow, and I mean as in a racing sense, you can be quick enough with things that you can do. And a lot of it comes from above the shoulders in sport. And it's the same with the horses. How many times do you hear a trainer talk about a happy horse? A happy horse is most likely going to get the most out of his racing career. But even beyond that and around that, it's a happy life. So, you know, I totally agree with everything you're talking about. Speaking of happy horses, guys. Yeah, absolutely. And I've plucked out this replay from 1981. We had a chat about San Simeon, remember last week or the week before, Matt? You mentioned San Simone, the great harness horse. Well, Simone, this is San Simeon. He only ever got beaten once in his career, and he dominated the Hobart Showgrounds, winning the Inter Dominion Pacing Championships in 1981.
San Simeon in full flight now, leading by a length from Jotari Knight. Then a length back on the inside is Single Again, looking for the way clear but can't get it. A length off the Frosty Empty, safe for the last run, but San Simeon's the leader. Racing inside the 400 by a length of a quarter on Jotari Knight, which is sticking to its guns. A neck back on the inside is Single Again. Frosty Empty taking on three wide, but San Simeon sprints away. 250 metres to go. He's put a great space in them now. He's about four lengths in front of Single Again. Jotari Knight, Frosty Empty can't run on. The one out wide on the course was out straw, but it's all over. San Simeon racing away for a brilliant win here in the 1981 Inter Dominion. San Simeon goes to the post for the running, and he wins by about 12 metres on Single Again. A length back on the outside, out straw.
George Grilicic, I think I was calling there, Hobart Showgrounds. I called out Sir Vancelot winning there. An amazing place. It's defunct now. It doesn't exist. There's the new Elwick facility for the trots there. Simply a great horse, a great time. It used to be showcased on TV. And I get to the next part of what I'm chatting about. You know the Inter Dominion's on now, guys, don't you? The third round's at Newcastle tomorrow and the grand final's next week at Menangle.
Well, publicised enough? Did I know enough? No, probably not.
Maybe the horses need to sell it, and they're just not enough depth in the King of Swings. They're an expensive ego, you know. They're two top liners, but the bottom really falls out. Unlike back in those days, maybe that's just the way it is, and we've got to accept it. But yeah, I agree with you, Matt. I really agree with you. The Inter Dominion's going to be in Melbourne next year, Simone. 12 months' time, it'll be here, and I reckon it'll be different. We'll make sure it's different. And I know Harness Racing Victoria will want to make sure it's different in the lead-up as well.
I was wondering that. Is it because it's in New South Wales that we're not getting the media coverage here that we would if it is in Victoria? Well, they've got their chance next year, haven't they, HRV? And no doubt it will be publicised. I mean, Trots are doing a terrific job of media at the moment with Trots Vision and all the rest of it. So hopefully next year it will be a different story, Dan.
Yep, a lot to look forward to on the show today. Matt, being Pakenham Cup Day, we're going to talk to the CEO.
Yeah, Blair Rodgers, who's the CEO. It's the sixth running, can you believe? It feels like the second or third, and standalones are a pretty big thing these days, so looking forward to having a chat to him about that. Also, night racing. Everyone wants to race at night. How many can or should? And also the growth of the training centre down there. So lots to talk about with Blair.
And maybe a few themes we can talk about too as far as night racing or day racing is concerned for all three codes. And we've got a very special guest as well, Simone.
We have Ray Fewings, South Australian race caller, who has hung up the binoculars after 60 years of race calling and being in the media. So really looking forward to the chat with Ray.
I hope everyone enjoys today's episode of Cracking the Codes.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the Codes.
We love cracking the codes here every Saturday morning, and we love it when we get a guest who has cracked all three codes as well. And our next guest comes from South Australia, someone that I've never actually met, but I have heard him and I have spoken to him before. And he certainly has had a hand in all of the three racing codes. And it's with great pleasure that I introduce Ray Fewings to Cracking the Codes this morning. Good morning, Ray.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about racing, which has been my life, yes.
Often, Ray, when you work in a broadcast role, you don't actually get that chance to speak about how you got into racing and the long career that you've had. So you've certainly got your platform this morning. So go for it and tell us everything that you can. A career that spans 60 years of calling. I mean, that's quite remarkable. And you started at 13 years old calling, which is a little bit later than Dan Malecki, who started at 9 years old. Was it Dan you started calling at nine?
Yeah, we got going early, but that's pretty young, Ray. And back at a time, it was pretty tough as well. I mean, you'd go through the traditional hard yards. You just didn't get planted a job because there was X amount of meetings about. You did the hard yards, didn't you? So even though you started young, you were being taught how to do it properly, perhaps radio skills involved. I mean, there's a lot more to it then than there is now.
Yeah, I probably started a lot earlier than that. I was a mad person who used to broadcast races as I ran to school. So that was 5 years onwards. But it all started when a horse trainer put a horse in our back paddock when I was about two, and I would toddle down there and just gaze at the horse for hours and hours. So that's probably where the interest came from way back then.
Ray, the voice, I mean, I grew up with that voice, listening to that voice, and calling all three codes as well. So I think that was the more traditional line, wasn't it? The race callers would call, well, not just all three codes, but be able to call anything. But you've got to start from somewhere, and we've all got our quirky stories as to what got us going. I remember Bill Collins was the paddle pops in the down the gutter, and mine was the 2 cent pieces in the passageway, and you know, I'm sure you mentioned you were calling you while you were running to school, and it's funny the things in our own mind. I guess like any kid, what they come up with, you know, it's an invisible friend or something like that. Sure. But we have vivid imaginations, and I'm sure yours was no different.
Well, my mother, I should explain. I have had a younger brother who was 3 years younger than me, and apparently I set up a racetrack in the backyard, and it was dead set in the walk between the back door and the outside toilet. And when my mother was pregnant with my brother, getting very close, obviously, she stumbled out during the night, and I used to race pegs around this makeshift track, and she tripped over my racetrack and went into labour. So
is that right?
So I was definitely doing it at 2 3/4 or something like that.
What was your brother named after that? Was there a racing sort of a name that came about?
No, that was Ian. But he turned out to be a racing journalist. So, yeah.
There you go. Obviously, there was something imprinted then when you had that racetrack made up and your poor mum stumbled out during the night. But, Ray, you started off in, well, you race pooling, but in a newspaper, didn't you? Like, is that sort of a traditional path for a lot of radio personalities, starting off in a newspaper and branching into radio?
Yeah, that's pretty well how it happened. Actually, how I got to call the races, there was a race caller in Adelaide who was a bit of a playboy, and the races were on a Sunday back then, and he'd apparently come across a lady that he thought a lot of, and this particular Sunday he never turned up. So they were calling over the public address, is there anyone that could call races? And I offered, and at first they shunned me and they said, you know, this is serious. They couldn't find anyone, so I did it, and it's gone from there. But yeah, I started off at the newspaper, and then when I was 25, I think I got a job calling races full time.
And you've also covered the America's Cup and the Seoul Olympics, so your career's definitely gone broader than just racing.
Yeah, I enjoyed doing the AFL and local football. Because I did play a bit of football as a teenager. So, yeah, I've really enjoyed the variety of it all. And at one stage I gave the race calling up to concentrate on more general sport. And I must say it probably did me a lot of good because it got me into talkback radio and I did politics and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's been a good variety. And Dan, I'm sure, would agree with me. I don't think I've ever worked a day in my life. It's all been my hobby, my passion.
Yeah, it's like that, isn't it? And people, I don't think they forget, but sometimes, you know, you remind them of the preparation that you put in beforehand, studying the colours and the form. And, you know, there are a lot of hours that you spend away from the racetrack in preparation for this, and mainly that's because of your love. You want to maintain a high level of professionalism, but... you know, and I can imagine in your days, earlier on at least, there was no field limit sizes. There was as many as it accepted, and it would find it very challenging, no matter where you went and the travel that's involved. And you wouldn't have the computer to rely on. You'd have to get things couriered to you, or you'd just get the local paper and then research on the race books that you may have kept previously. I mean, it's all sort of right there at your fingertips now, but it wasn't then.
I think I was blessed with a good memory. I mean, I can still remember laying in a cot looking at a picture on the wall with flamingos in it. So that was 1 or 2 years of age. So if you've got a good memory, it makes the job a lot easier.
Well, that is a good memory, Ray. I've got to tell you, I don't think there are things I might be able to remember when I'm about 6 or 7, but it's funny. It's all about racehorses. And I can relate to where I was in time by the racehorses or the race meeting I was at, and even as a 5 and 6 year old, but they're just a vivid moment in a cloudy memory, if that makes sense. But it's all racing related.
Yeah. I can still see the parade ring right now of a horse called Tobin Bronze strutting around having his first race at Cheltenham. Wow. Magnificent looking animal, and he ran third that day, but he won the very next start afterwards. And when you look back, he was one of the greatest horses of all time. Some of his weight carrying performances are unbelievable.
Yeah, and to win those races and then to represent Australia overseas again and really get that, putting Australia back on the international stage again, that is something you would cherish then, remembering that, super horse.
Yeah, indeed. And Tullock the day he came to Adelaide, those sort of things, they make an impression on you that anchor you to the sport for life.
Ray, in 60 years of calling, I'm sure there's been plenty of memorable, not just moments, but races as well, and some of the horses that you've called, Sub-Zero, you've called him over there, and many others. But what are some of the memorable races for you?
The funny thing is, it's the things the ones you remember is when the unusual happens. I remember I was calling a race at Balaclava one day, and the clerk of the course had been gifted a newly retired racehorse. Someone had retired their galloper, and they said, oh, this is a lovely pony. He'd be terrific as a clerk of the course's horse. So the clerk took the horse, and he decided to give him a spin at Balaclava this particular day. And it was only a small field, I remember that. And I remember them jumping away, and I called Happy Boy in front of my name's Bob. And then I said, and running third under a very good hold is the clerk of the course. It turned out that when the barriers opened and the horses took off, so did the clerk of the course's horse. And it was an unbelievable sight seeing the clerk of the course up there running third and trying desperately to restrain his horse out of the field. But I did play it for all it was worth, I must admit.
So what was the end result in that race then? Was it a no race, or did it affect the finishing order?
He managed to get to the outside and travel wide around the turn and eventually ease out of the race, but it was fun while it lasted.
Would have been distracting though too, you'd imagine.
Yeah, it was. But that was one of the lighter things. Another occasion, and this was more serious, Cheltenham races one day, one of the barrier attendants had gone to the local for a pre-race drink with a couple of mates. And he kept looking at his watch and realised he'd cut it a bit fine. So he arrived at the track, and the entrance for the staff was at about the 2,000-metre mark. There was a gate there, and they were able to drive through that gate and make their way around to where the barrier attendants were working, but he cut it so fine that the horses in a 2,400 metre race had already jumped, and he drove his car onto the track, and the horses were oncoming, and I was calling the race, and you can imagine my amazement when they got round to the 2,000. I said, so-and-so's in front of so-and-so, and lo and behold, there's a car parked on the track, and he'd panicked and stopped on the running rail. And suddenly the horses came around the bend, and jockeys panicked and took action to avoid. But sadly, one of the horses at the back cannoned straight into the car and broke its leg, and, oh, there was hell to pay over it. But I couldn't believe that when the bloke was trying to get to the barriers before the start.
That would really knock you for the rest of the meeting too, wouldn't it? It would probably put you off guard for the rest of the races.
Certainly did. Probably on a personal note, one of the most memorable races I can remember was I was about 13, and we had a greyhound dog, and we had two sisters, and one was about 5 or 6 lengths quicker than the other. But unfortunately, it got distemper and died. So we were left with this one, my father and I were left with this one that was 6 lengths inferior. And I remember saying to Dad, you know, I don't know why we're going to keep this one when the other one was so much superior. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we took it to Victoria and took it to the Geelong trials. And in those days, there were private trials and no one was allowed to watch. So you had to queue up behind this big mound so as to make sure no one could see the trials. And there was a fellow in the queue next to me, and we started talking, and he said, son, what have you got there? And I said, oh, I've got this pup. I said, we don't think it's much good, but we've brought it over here to see if it will chase the lure. We think it will, but we're not sure. Anyway, he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, you can put your dog around with mine, and it can follow my dog. So we agreed to that, and eventually got onto the track, and we put them in the boxes together, and lo and behold, they went round head and head all the way, and we were catching the dogs, and this fellow said to me, okay, son, he said, you've had a bit of a laugh. He said, what is that dog? And I said, well, it's an unraced puppy, and, you know, what I said to you was right. And he said, well, that's bullshit. He said, this dog broke the track record last week. So we left the track on a bit of a high, thinking, well, maybe we've got something. Anyway, we entered the, while we were in Melbourne on holidays, we entered the dog for Warrnambool about a week later, and it was in a maiden race there. And we went down, and I'll never forget Warrnambool in those days. There wasn't much electric light. Every bookie had a globe above his stand, and that was basically all the light for the public. And it was a pretty rundown track. I remember there was a rabbit burrow on the inside of the track at one stage around when we walk into the boxes. Anyway, the dog opened up about 3-1, and my uncle had a bit of money to put on, and he was waiting and waiting, thinking it would get out. And then suddenly this group of men appeared from nowhere, and they backed the dog into odds on. And obviously the word from the trial at Geelong had got out. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it won easily. And a month later, it went back there and won the free-for-all. So it was turned out to be a pretty decent dog.
Can you remember the name?
Dark Hedge, it was called.
Dark Hedge. I'm sure there'll be some listeners that do remember that, Ray, so much for private trials.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just for the record, the dog that I trialled with was a dog called Salty Lass, and it was trained by a man called Bill Leckie, I think.
And, his name does pop up.
Turned out to be a good, it was a pretty hot sort of a dog, yeah.
The amount of racetracks in South Australia that are now defunct in all three codes, I mean, you'd have to remember fondly, but, you know, Cheltenham and Victoria Park are two places that stand out. There must be plenty that you called at that are no longer there.
Yes, you're right about that. We used to go to Yardunda, Morgan, Talem Bend. There was a track at Cadena. So one by one, they've all sort of closed down. I must tell you another really funny story. When I was working for the newspaper, we used to go with a senior journalist, and I was a cadet. And we worked for Rupert Murdoch, and the cars were governed, so they couldn't go faster than 100K or 60 miles an hour. And I remember we came to this big hill one day, and this senior journalist was a bit of a daredevil, and he pulled out in traffic and went to make a run on the wrong side of the road. And, of course, we got up to 60 miles an hour, and we weren't gaining any ground. We were stuck out there in genuinely the death seat, and there was a truck coming. And I don't know how we got out of it, but for a while there, we didn't think we were going to make it.
No, more challenging than just calling a big field at Morfordville then.
another time we sent a bloke to the country races, and we relied on him to come back with all the results, and he was late, a few hours late, and I remember having to ring all the pubs between the racetrack and Adelaide to trace his movements to make sure that he was genuinely not far from home. And every time I rang a pub, they said, yeah, he was here, but he left some time ago.
So he didn't have Facebook back in those days where he was posting to all his mates where he was at that particular time to track him. But Ray, the three codes that you've called, you've also, your partner Jane is an owner of some terrific dogs, owned some terrific dogs over the years, including True to Do and Tuggera that people would remember. But the codes yourself, you've dabbled in training too, haven't you, with horses?
Yeah, I had trotters for a long time. Dan, I was around in the good days, you know, with Pure Steel and Popular Arm and Powerface Adios, and I had a couple of nice ones myself, but I never really went on with it. I had a good horse called Fearless Quick, who won a derby, and he ran second to
Gary
Fly.
Yeah,
in an Australian derby. But I've never made any money out of the trots. But the dogs at the moment in Adelaide, they are fantastic. The economy of the dogs here is terrific, and twice this year, Greyhound Racing SA handed out $1 million in bonuses to the participants just to tide them over because things were going so well. So it's at the moment it's the sport to be in.
We were the recipients of those bonuses too, Ray. Raced a couple of dogs there midway through the year, and then ended up with this extra money in the account, wondered where it had come from, and it was the bonuses. And you, under the direction of Matt Corby there, who we all know from Sandown many years ago, but you're on the board of Greyhound Racing SA also. It looks like it's heading in the right direction. The bridge at the track at Murray Bridge, it's relatively new, the upgrade at Angle Park recently. Looks like you've got good times ahead for Adelaide Racing with Greyhounds.
Yeah, I think it's you can't go wrong in investing in Greyhounds in SA at the moment. Of course, out of COVID, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But while we were in COVID, the betting was unbelievable, particularly with the corporate bookmakers.
It was much the same across the board here in Victoria as well. I mean, it's probably not something that realistically is going to continue on that path, but the fact that we did have that injection of funds during COVID has been great for the code. But, Ray, after 60 years of calling, what was it? It's an enormous career, but what was it that actually, you know, made it for you that, okay, this is enough now, even though you've enjoyed every minute of it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think everyone that, well, Dan will tell you that any race caller is his own best critic. And the public mightn't know when you've called badly or not up to scratch, but you do. And you know when you struggle or when you're not as sharp as you should be. And a couple of times lately, I found it more difficult. I'm 74 now. I found it more difficult to concentrate. And when I was young, I lived on adrenaline and I lived the sports and I could recognise horses even without the jockeys on. And lately, I've found it more difficult to concentrate. And I thought, well, instead of being one of those old buggers that people talk about going for too long, I thought, well, I'd better quit while I'm ahead.
Some people have got the voice, though, Ray, and I think your voice is something that resonates. And I say this honestly, it's a voice that I've known for a long, long time. And when I heard you back calling those greyhounds again, I must admit there's a certain quality involved. You could have been calling the dogs in completely wrong order and by the wrong names, but it sounded really good to me. So, you know, that voice is such a part of horse racing. Or greyhound racing as well. I tell you one thing about South Australians growing up. It seemed, it's almost like the, you know, football teams. You can liken it to the football teams, and SA was nearly always the best football team as far as the states were concerned collectively. And it was very much the same with the horsemen. You would have been in an era where you had Bart Cummings, Colin Hayes, John Hawkes, then in the Justice brothers, also Jeff Webster, you know, youngish at the time, Ross Sugars, a lot of them had then left to go to either New South Wales or to Victoria. But again, collectively, may well have been the best bunch of horse people that the industries have come across that you would have been calling.
Yeah, undoubtedly. That was a great era to grow up in, and back in those days, particularly racing and harness, they were the things to do of a weekend. And don't forget the race callers too. You've got Bruce McAvaney. He worked, started off while I was calling. He was my understudy for a while, and I look at how well he did. And Brian Martin was here for a while. So we've really produced some outstanding young blokes that have gone right on with the job in other states.
You're certainly in a club there of elite race callers and media personalities, Ray. Just before we let you go, it's been wonderful talking to you this morning. If you were to pick a greyhound, a trotter or pacer and a galloper from each of the three codes that you consider to be the best that you've called, maybe not the best horse or dog, but the best that you've called, what would they be off the top of your head?
Well, I suppose the horse that I was used to love was Galilee. He was sort of my era, and I remember at the end of his career, he spent a bit of time at Lenny Smith's stables, and I actually went down and saw the horse close up a few times. He was a fabulous galloper, and they were the Johnny Miller days when he came over from Western Australia, and he was a hands and heels jockey, and had such great success for Bart Cummings. I love Bart. I mean, you could talk to Bart, and he was the same all the time. He was witty. If you got a bit too cocky, he'd cut you down, and I just loved him. He was my idol, really. And he had to achieve too, because Colin Hayes and the top trainers at the time, they didn't like this precocious up and comer, and they put a few hurdles in his way to slow him up. I remember he got 12 months one time, Bart Cummings, because he had a 2-year-old that ran last first up, and he put the blinkers on it, and it bolted in, and they gave him 12 months. So they made it very hard for Bart when he was coming up through the ranks, but he triumphed pretty well. So that would be the galloper. I got to call some really good horses. I called the End of the Million with Car Clue and with Gamma Light, but you know, your outstanding horses like Popular Arm and Pure Steel, and some of the great trotters, Maori's Idol and Night Pistol. And I remember calling a race at Globe Derby where Pride of Petite, the New Zealander, came around them 5 wide and won in a finish with 4 or 5 horses across the track. That was about as good as it can get. And as far as the greyhounds are concerned, there's been just so many champions, but I probably was most impressed by the ones right at the start. Dogs like Bristol Sioux and White Panther and some fabulous greyhounds have raced in Adelaide over the years. It's been a privilege. There's no other way to describe it.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of our listeners that will remember those greyhounds. They're not names that spring to my mind, Ray, but given that it was many decades ago, and I'm sure there's many listeners who can relate to those horses and the greyhounds. Well, look, it's been a wonderful chat this morning. Thoroughly enjoyed talking to you and giving us a snapshot of your career and some of the funny stories and also the more serious ones. But it's been wonderful. So thank you very much for your time this morning and joining Dan and I on Cracking the Codes.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. And it's a pity that we don't get more coverage like this for the sports. I think that's one of the reasons why racing in general is not getting the coverage it used to. I mean, people lived for the racing when I was younger, and I've watched it sort of fade away in the general public's opinion of late, and that's sad for me because it's been fabulous to be involved in, and people don't know what they're missing if they're not involved in racing of some form.
Yep, no, there's no doubt about that. As they say, there's nothing like the smell of horse manure in the morning, is there? So
it's better than dog poo. I can give you the big tip. I do both, cleaning up horse manure and dog poo in the morning. So I'm speaking from first-hand experience here.
Ray, absolute pleasure having you on. Hopefully now that the borders are starting to open up, or we anticipate they will, I can come across and have a chat with you. It'd be great to do. You've got so many stories there. And if it's all right with you, we wouldn't mind tapping into that again another day on Cracking the Codes as well.
No worries. Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, great interview with Ray Fewings there. It's a big race day again. It doesn't seem like we get any softer days through the course of the year, which is fantastic. We're on a high at the moment. And one of the prettiest tracks I think that you can look at is Pakenham on the TV. And I know that will please Matt Stewart because he's big about the aesthetics and the beauty of the racetracks. And I love that contrast of the green on white and a beautiful surface. We get a lot of positive feedback about Pakenham. And I'm enjoying trying to find a winner for today, Matt.
Indeed. These standalones have become quite the thing these days. And looking forward to the roundabout swinging to Pakenham. Blair Otkers is the CEO of Pakenham, and time does fly, Blair. This is the 6th standalone for Pakenham.
Yes, it's very exciting when we get all the lights shine here on this wonderful facility, and Metropolitan Racing on a Saturday afternoon is exactly where we like to be. So very proud to have a standalone race meeting, and hopefully it will be an enjoyable day for all.
You've had a couple of years of COVID, of course, and then a sense of the reopening. Just take us through the crowd situation today, and for those who are sitting at home, well, might even go to Pakenham. Is it a rock up the gate scenario? What's the anticipated crowd? And if anyone still wants to go, can they just rock up?
Due to the COVID restrictions, early doors, we had to put a restriction on of 5,000 in line with the government guidelines. As they've lifted, we did decide to stay in and around that restricted mark of 5,000. Ticket sales have us positioned right on that mark, and we're forecasting a crowd probably just short or just over 5,000 to the race day. It is a pre-purchase ticket event only, so to require to get in attendance, you will have been required to purchase a pre-purchase ticket online. So at the gate, sales won't be available. That's just purely because of the COVID safe guidelines and the activities associated with that.
Blair, I mentioned before about the aesthetics, and Matt's always big on the beauty of the racetracks. It doesn't matter what coat it is, and I agree, particularly when they're showcased on television. I enjoy Pakenham. I think it's really showcased well, and the contrast with the other tracks, the white rails, the grass always seems greener there. Is that right?
Beautiful Kaikoura grass out here at Pakenham, Dan. It's a wonderful surface. It's a wonderful circuit. Big open spaces with the vast green that comes around. It's such a gorgeous facility, and it's actually maturing over the years beautifully. We're getting some of the trees and the gardens really starting to mature after, you know, it's been like 7, 8 years now that they've been in. So little things like that really mark a beautiful race course. And of course, this race meeting, we open up the 1200 metre shoot for the first time. So we've extended the 1000 metre shoot to 1200 metres, and that'll give a nice long stretch of green Kaikoura for the horses to go down.
And that's a shoot there's what, 200 metres that previously hasn't been used before. So that takes a bit of artwork in itself to sew it in and match it up with the you know, what is before the 1,000 then.
Yeah, so it was originally designed as a 1,200 metre shoot. In original constructions, we did hit a sinkhole problem, which required a couple of years of remedy, but now we've extended that final 200 metres of that shoot. It's been occurring over the last 12 to 18 months, and we've allowed a long growing in period. And yes, certainly the integration between the existing and the new has been a challenge, but I think when you'll see them run over that, you'll probably barely even notice where it actually joins. The guys out on the track have done such a wonderful job, and it's a beautiful long straight. It won't impact racing at all.
Well, you must be wrapped with the field that you've got assembled, all the big trainers heading to Pakenham today. It must give you, particularly coming out of COVID as well, and the first big race meeting for a while, it must be really making you feel good about what's ahead for the rest of the day.
Yeah, we're always excited to get the best of Victorian racing here at Pakenham, and the card today looks exactly that. We've got some big names, and of course, you know, we welcome back Jamie Carr, who will be mounting up on the favourite in today's Cup from a riding perspective. The fields across the board are very strong. I think they're very reflective of a good metropolitan Saturday afternoon race card. And, we're really thankful that for everyone that enjoys racing here at Pakenham, and I think the track gives every horse a good chance to find their position and find a win. So it doesn't surprise that the big names within racing certainly enjoy racing at Pakenham.
Well, I just want to ask you about, I've been a bit fascinated by the ambitions of various clubs in regards to night racing. Of course, the $2.5 billion Moonee Valley project we're about to embark on that, and that's going to be very big on the night racing.
Night racing is a particular strength of our club with the lights in place. And I can see why many other clubs are pursuing or looking at the opportunity for night racing. It provides a spectacle very different to afternoon racing. It allows you to serve a different a type of clientele and a different meal and a different function offering. So it is from an on-course perspective, a beautiful way to showcase racing. The challenge, of course, is finding the balance within the industry of getting night racing at the right level. One of the often forgotten challenges for our industry participants, our trainers and our track work riders, the last race might go, you've conducted under lights, and then the next morning they're going to be up bright and early to get to track work. So too much night racing is absolutely a possibility, and we need to balance that very, very mindfully, because, as you mentioned, training at Pakenham is only going from strength to strength, where our horse numbers now sit around 350 horses in work on average per month. That's only growing, and we forecast that to jump the 500 horses within the next 3 years. Stabling is being constructed at a rapid pace out here at Pakenham. Racing Victoria have just completed 120 stables, and across other trainer allotments, we've got a forecast another 150 that will be developed in the next 12 months. So as the stables on course become more readily available, the horses do arrive quickly. So it's a wonderful facility here. We've got our uphill training track that will be constructed hopefully in 2022. The facilities are really starting to settle and mature. We've got some great surfaces. So it's a real strength of Pakenham, and add that to night racing. It makes a great offering for someone to base themselves here.
Got an idea, guys. See what you think of this. You've got to laugh at me at first. Halloween's got a bit bigger in Australia, maybe through the COVID period. But imagine a night race meeting, Halloween, promote it, an all fillies and mares card, and we would promote it as a nightmare program. What do you reckon?
You're the man of ideas, Dan.
Just to Blair about how good it is to latch onto a theme, the Moonee Valley with its Chinese New Year and so on. So even if it's Halloween or something else, how important is it to get a theme night?
I think it's really important to link into to the community and community engagement. We've many clubs and this club have tried to generate a theme around a race day, and that is really hard, and it's a tough battle to do. But when a theme pre-exists, like a Chinese night, a New Year, or a Halloween, or whatever it may be, it makes it easier when the community actually understands that and is aware of it. So I always look for opportunities around pre-existing community activities and community events and community and religious themes, whatever it may be. So very important, but one thing that about event is you do need to find the ground and hold that ground strong, because events do take some time to generate, and not everything happens overnight, and some events just need to be built on year on year.
Well, I've got another follow-on from Dan's suggestion. Perhaps Dan could be the guest of honour and he could walk in singing Alice Cooper's Welcome to My Nightmare. Could that be... Could that be on the cards as well? Might be onto something, Dan. I think it sounds like a good suggestion. Blair, what do you think?
Yeah, Dan's dulcet tones are always welcome at Pakenham, when we've got a beautiful indoor event centre and a big stage. So if Dan wants to break one out, always welcome.
I tell you what, I like Only Women Bleed, Alice Cooper song. I can sing that. I would have a crack at that, which also might be appropriate on that particular night. Blair, great opportunity again to highlight the Pakenham track, a venue that's really emerging. It's going places for lots of different reasons, and we're glad to see it in the spotlight today, and we hope you have a wonderful Cup Day.
Thanks for your time, guys.
Terrific. Thanks to Blair. Simone, you could wear that puffy shirt that you used to clean up at the fashions on the field back in the 70s and 80s to a Halloween themed night.
I was born in the 70s, so I don't know what puffy shirt that would have been then, but I'm sure I could drag something out of the cupboard. But maybe you could go as Frankenfurter, Matt, get in the suspenders and the stilettos.
Yeah, no, well, it wouldn't be the first time with that game. So, more than happy to. Dan, I know it's probably standard a bit silly coming up, but you're probably right, where Halloween, what are the things that people are latching onto, and how can racing latch onto them? And maybe Halloween, because to get the kids involved, if all the kids could get there with all their little goblin and witches and warlock outfits and all that sort of stuff, it may actually be kooky enough to work.
That's a good idea.
If the kids want to go, they have to be taken by chaperones or their parents. The whole family goes. If the whole family goes, that can't be a bad thing. I had another idea for something, and I know people will come at me left, right and centre, but for the trots, and I've got to the stage, this OH&S stuff, you know, it can give you the you-know-whats at times because it's too far overfetched and people use it as an excuse to not do something. But one of the ideas I had was a dog day afternoon, right? And you take your dog to the races, or in this case, the trots. Now, obviously, you might have to fan out a couple of races. Everyone that goes there, if you're taking your dog, the whole family goes, the kids, the mum, the dad. It's a great opportunity for a day out. And let them all run up the home straight at, say, Melton in this case, or any of the country tracks. You get a huge turnout, and I reckon it would be just a great thing. Try a few different things. You don't want to just get people there. You want to get families there. So, and look, for every... If you had 100 ideas and 5 of them worked, I reckon you've succeeded. So we keep, you know, coming up with those sorts of thoughts. We want to get people that want to enjoy the race day there. And, well, the funny thing is we go to the horse racing and the humans watch. We go to the dogs and the humans watch. But when the humans are racing, you don't see the dogs and the horses watching you, do you? So, you know, there's another thing to think of.
Well, the running race up the straight, the Christmas theme at the Hillsville every year for the kids, it's enormous. Well, half the parents go is because the kids know that the Santa race is on at Hillsville. So, yeah, we'll all be working in marketing, and I believe those marketing people get paid a fortune. So, yeah, let's work on this, guys.
Yeah, it's something we can come up with ourselves. I'm sure there's something in that, especially at this time of the year over a few quiet ales and red wines. Matt, Simone, been a lot of fun once again this morning. We're getting close to Christmas now, so we'll get that opportunity for those ales and red wines. Hey, thanks again for this morning. We had some wonderful interviews, and I hope you both enjoy, firstly, your day and your week until we talk again next Saturday morning on Cracking the Codes.